Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with David Anderson, international pioneering top authority in Agile, Lean, Kanban methodology, and CMMI. David, I'm just looking at your background. You have such a remarkable history of significant global impact in software development, performance improvement, Agile software development, and as a founder of the Agile movement. And as a founder of the APLN, a nonprofit dedicated to improving management and leadership in technology companies. You're also the leading international thought leader in business agility and enterprise scale agile software transitions through the CMMI model integrated with agile lean methods. Thank you for sharing your considerable expertise, deep accumulated insights and wisdom with our audience.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. I feel almost embarrassed by that introduction. Founder of the Agile movement, maybe. I was in the room at the time when an Agile method was created, but I've certainly been involved for more than a decade and certainly before we called them Agile methods.
Well, your history is renowned, and I just got back from the World CIO Forum, and I was talking to some of the thought leaders there, and they mentioned your name as just really the guru in the field. So because of that, can you share your pioneering work in the Agile and Lean methodology movement?
Sure. 1997, I was invited to move to Singapore, work on a large project at a local bank there, United Overseas Bank. And there were a number of really good, strong people on that project, including Jeff DeLuca, who was the project director, Peter Code, who was famous for his books on object-oriented analysis and design, a number of others who emerged since then as really thought leaders, like Stephen Palmer, who co-authored the book on feature-driven development. And during that time, we created the feature-driven development method as really a synthesis of Peter Code's object-oriented analysis and design method and Jeff DeLuca's project management methods. So that was 97 through 99, and then after that I worked as a lead or a manager at a number of projects introducing the feature-driven development method, 1999 in Ireland, and then 2000 at Sprint CS in Kansas City, and then later at Motorola's PCS division, the cell phone, the mobile phone division of Motorola that's now called Motorola Mobility. And during that same time frame, the Agile movement really emerged as a number of thought leaders got together and the Agile Manifesto was written and so on. So I was really involved from the beginning there. A few years later, Jim Highsmith pulled some people together to try and write what he casually described as the Agile Project Management Manifesto. And what came out of that was a statement of values that was called the Declaration of Interdependence, for some somewhat pompous reasons, perhaps. And a new not-for-profit called the Agile Project Leadership Network, or the APLN. So I was involved in that from the beginning. And at the same time, I was working at Microsoft by then, trying to merge some ideas such as CMMI with Agile and other management thinking, W. Edward Deming's thinking on variation, and merge all those ideas together. And I did that for a couple of years, and then eventually moved to a private firm that's owned by Bill Gates. And I led the software engineering organization there. And it was during that time that the Kanban method that I'm now famous for emerged. And since January 2008, I've been running my own management consulting and training company. And we've been evangelizing the Kanban method around the world. And it's really catching on. We're having a lot of success with it.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating history. So for that reason, I'd like to get into more detail in Kanban just a little bit later in the interview. But before we do that, you mentioned Motorola, but I know you've also spent time with Sprint and working on Corbis. So can you describe some of the lessons from your time managing teams at Sprint, Motorola, and with Corbis?
Sure. Well, I think it's a general problem of what are the challenges of being a middle manager in big corporate America. I really came to realize that leadership is important. It's important to work for good leaders. And when you're thinking about taking a job, you need to look at the guy who's offering the job to you and perhaps even his boss and ask yourself, are these people good leaders? Do they have the courage of conviction to do what needs to be done? And at the same time, you need to look at your own team and identify the natural leaders on that team, and you need to nurture that leadership, because really without leadership, nothing else works. And I've come to realize that leadership is very much the secret ingredient in any Kanban implementation. So leadership would probably be my number one if you're asking me for five ideas. Communication is probably the next one. Communication is huge. And I've come to realize what we do for a living is invisible work. And in order for people to be able to work effectively doing it, they need to make that invisible work visible. So communication is important, and the most critical thing there is making the invisible work visible. So that would probably be my second one. What else? Up management is important. When you're introducing agile methods, it's news for managers who grew up with a more traditional approach, and therefore it's important to educate more senior people on the information, how you'll be working, why it's better, investing in the education of bosses so that they don't freak out when you give them some new approach and new data and information, and seek to understand the problems that they have. Try and put yourself inside the head of those more senior managers and ask yourself, what questions do I need answered? And when you're up managing, when you're investing in educating those bosses, you should be able to repeat those questions so that it will resonate with them, and then show them how you can still answer those questions, even though it's perhaps with different information than they've been used to. Probably next on my list is the fact that you can have a team that's working obviously better, producing better software faster with higher quality, self-evidently better results, and other teams in the same building, often on the same floor of the same building doing very similar work, will still resist adoption of the techniques that the successful team is using. And no end of logical argument will overcome the resistance, because the resistance is emotional. And that was really the big lesson that I learned during my Motorola period. That it was a pattern I'd seen previously at Sprint, and by the time I saw it again, so, you know, 2-3 years later, I thought that this is clearly a pattern. It's not just some random event. It's not unique to those people in that particular building in Kansas City. It is, in fact, a commonly occurring problem. So people will resist adoption of new techniques, and you need to find ways of motivating people to embrace change and recognize that that motivation has to overcome their emotional resistance. And then finally, I think it's worth adding to the list here that most knowledge workers that come to work pretty much assume that they're doing a good job, that they're working hard, they're applying their intellect and education as best they can. And when you suggest to them that performance improvement is possible, that idea will sound ridiculous to them. They'll resist it. The bottom line is that they believe they're already pretty efficient. What they're, of course, thinking about is their own personal efficiency and productivity. And often the problems are organizational, and they're in the handoffs and interactions between people and between different departments. And that's where the delays and problems and quality issues come from. So you'll often find that people are quite resistant to the idea that their organization can be improved, because they believe that the organization is the sum of its parts, and they, as one of the parts, are already doing their best. So when you walk into a situation as a change agent, as a manager or a consultant, and you know that performance needs to improve, then you need to tread very carefully. And I've come to realize that avoiding use of the word performance is actually important. It's much more useful to talk about capability and to talk about the capability of the organization. And if you suggest that the organization's capability needs to improve, strangely, that doesn't meet with resistance. So I think those are probably my top five lessons from my time as a big corporate manager.
I just love those lessons. You know, you talk about leadership and communication and op management and sort of a best practice adoption within the company, but being sort of resisted because of the emotional context, and this idea, the word performance is like a trigger word. I just think that's so interesting. Now, earlier you talked about working at Microsoft, and I know you did some really important work there. Can you describe that work and outline some best practices and then benefits resulting from this work?
Sure, just very briefly. Microsoft hired me really for my process expertise to embed that process guidance into their Visual Studio Team System product, which I believe they now call Visual Studio ALM, or Application Lifecycle Management. And specifically, their process method that they call MSF, it's really just an acronym. Technically, it stands for Microsoft Solutions Framework, but no one really knows what that means. So that they were delivering two versions of their MSF, an agile version and a version that was compatible with CMMI Level 3. And I primarily contributed to the CMMI version. I had my colleague Randy Miller did most of the work on the agile method, although there was certainly a cross-pollination of ideas, and we all contributed. So what I was doing at Microsoft was really taking my prior history with feature-driven development, my management experience at Sprint and Motorola, and what I'd been learning more recently with the teachings of Edward Deming, and I merged all of those together and created an agile method that was compatible with CMMI Level 3, and wrote all the guidance for that, and that was embedded in their product that was launched in 2005. And I was continuing to stay there and work on the next version, but during that time I was approached to lead the software engineering organization at Corbis, and it was too good of an opportunity to turn down. I really wanted to be working with a real team, doing real software development again, and it turned out to be a hugely fortunate opportunity, because that's where the Kanban method emerged. I really valued my time at Microsoft. I enjoyed working with the people there. They gave me some great opportunities, really good exposure. And it was during that time that I really forged my friendship and quite deep relationship with the people at the Software Engineering Institute at Carnegie Mellon University. So I really value the opportunity, and I look back on that time as an important and really quite pivotal point in my career.
You wrote this book. Can you describe your first book and some tips from that book?
Yeah, my first book's called Agile Management for Software Engineering. And really the premise of that book was to demonstrate to an audience reading it in 2003 that agile methods could be applied in larger corporations, and that there was a logical reason for pursuing adoption of them, which was very simply that there was a better economic outcome from the use of agile methods. While if I was writing a book with that premise today, I would have additional insights and perhaps additional models to introduce. Primarily, the model in that book was the theory of constraints, and the idea that if software development was your bottleneck, then agile development would help you alleviate that and produce an overall better economic outcome from your software and product development activities. So the better economic outcome was the main message. And then underlying that was the lean product development idea that we should manage the flow of software development by identifying individual units of work like features, use cases, user stories, and so on. And manage the flow of those through our organization, through the requirement, elaboration, and analysis, and development, testing, and deployment. And that by managing that flow, we would be able to really improve the performance. As I said earlier, that often it's not the individuals or how they are thinking and working that's the issue. It's the gaps in between. And by looking at that end-to-end problem, we could manage that flow better. In order to do that, of course, we had to make the invisible work visible. And the method for doing that was the idea of tracking work in a system like Visual Studio Team System, for example, and then using the data from that to visualize it with a chart called a cumulative flow diagram. And those diagrams were capable of exposing bottlenecks and demonstrating how much demand we had and what our capability was to supply, and also the amount of variability in our processing and in the arrival rate of the demand. So very rich information just from one chart. So the book contained this idea that there was a better economic outcome, that we should manage flow, that understanding where bottlenecks were in our process was a way of focusing our improvement efforts. And we could see all of that with this cumulative flow diagram metric. And if there was one other thing that's a recurring undercurrent in the book, it was the idea that we should be moving to a probabilistic approach to management rather than a deterministic approach. So traditional project management methods had really taken a deterministic approach to say that we could understand the work we were doing in terms of its sequence and how long it would take. And that was really quite deterministic. I know I'm repeating the same word several times here. So there's this undercurrent in that first book that it would be better to take more of a statistical, probabilistic approach, and that could in fact save us a lot of work rather than doing extensive planning and analysis and estimation to create deterministic plans. We could do really quite lightweight analysis and use probabilistic approaches that would enable us to make really quite accurate plans quickly. The net outcome is we'd spend way less money doing planning and much less time, which would enable us to get started faster. So a number of core themes there: managing flow, making invisible work visible, probabilistic versus deterministic management approaches, and really introducing the word bottleneck into the lexicon of the software development community.
And I guess that's sort of a natural segue then into your recent book and this whole area of Kanban methodology. And I've got a series of questions on this, and you sort of have referred to Kanban earlier, so let's now kind of drill down. Now, what is Kanban basically, and what are the benefits that companies can draw from it?
So first of all, it's worth understanding the origin of the name. The concept of a Kanban system is widely used in the manufacturing industry. It's a technique from Japan, and Kanban systems are older than their usage in manufacturing. Usually people associate the introduction of Kanban systems at Toyota approximately 1948. And a Kanban system is the concept of a quantity of what are called Kanban, literally translated as signal card, which circulate inside a factory or some organization to both regulate the quantity of, in the case of a factory, the inventory of components moving around that factory. And they also signal when more components or inventory are required. So as a component is used and integrated into a bigger product, its Kanban that's associated with it is recycled, and that recycling signals a request to fetch more components from a warehouse. So the idea with a Kanban system is that you have understood a quantity of work which can be conducted in a controlled fashion. And by controlling the quantity of work, you avoid overburdening the system and you put a considerable amount of predictability into how the system operates, how long it takes for work to move from the front to the end of the system, the lead time, as it's known. So you improve the predictability of the system, you avoid overburdening, and avoiding overburdening has other benefits, particularly a quality benefit. So this technique had been used in manufacturing for perhaps 50 years, slightly over 50 years, when I first introduced it with a team at Microsoft in 2004. Where we introduced the use of a Kanban system on a software maintenance team in the IT division. And it had a really dramatic effect in terms of their throughput of change requests. So the delivery rate of completed work, as well as the lead time for that completion and the predictability of the system, the lead times dropped by about 90% from 5 months to 2 weeks. The predictability went up from 0% on time to 98% on time, and we more than trebled the productivity, the delivery rate of the work. So the introduction of a Kanban system seemed like an attractive idea. But really what we're talking about with the Kanban method goes even beyond that, although the name comes from the introduction of a Kanban system. So in 2007, we introduced a Kanban system again with the software engineering organization at Corbis, but we also introduced some new ways of visualizing the work and some feedback mechanisms involving the use of stand-up meetings and managerial operation reviews on a monthly basis. And the combination of all of these things created something different and somewhat unexpected. It created a method for evolving an existing process over time and incrementally improving it, where the catalyst of those improvements was the combination of this Kanban system that was limiting the work in progress along with the visualization. So we were able to see the invisible work, to see its flow or the lack of it, and to control the amount of work in the system using the technically a virtual Kanban, because there are no physical Kanban cards in the system. And all of that came together, and what we had invented is the wrong word, and yet discovered is also not the right word. So I struggle for the word, but what had emerged was a completely new approach to improving the agility of software development organizations. So some people like Alan Shalloway have, for example, described it as a second generation agile method. I'm not sure whether that's appropriate or not, but it remains that Alan did say that. And in some ways it's fair. Alistair Coburn described agile methods as what he called stretch to fit. He said that no one agile method was sufficient for any given context, and that when you applied an agile method, you had to add additional things to it to stretch it to fit your situation. And he compared that as very different to 20th century process approaches, which he described as shrink to fit, where you would have a very large corporate process manual. And when you decided to start a project, a process engineer would arrive to meet with the project manager to help them analyze the risks and the context for the project and tailor down the corporate standard process down to a smaller version which would be used on that project. So that was shrink to fit. Agile, on the other hand, was stretch to fit, which was start with an agile method out of the textbook and then add in additional things in order to cover the particular context and risks. The challenge there was no specific guidance on how to do the stretching, no guidance on what should be added in order to fit into a context, where the Kanban method really introduces a third way, which I've described as evolve to fit, that you start with whatever you're doing now and you apply a Kanban system and visualization, and you start limiting the work in progress and managing the flow, and you make the management policies explicit, and you give the workforce a little bit of education on process dynamics. And what begins to happen is that the process evolves, that the team and the immediate management start proposing small little changes. And over time, and that time can be short, sometimes 5, 6, 7 weeks, 2, 3 months perhaps, the process evolves really quite dramatically, and they start adopting practices that we would associate with agile software development methods. But they adopt those in a very context-specific way. So Kanban really is introducing a new way of improving the agility of organizations. And perhaps it is appropriate that it's called a second-generation agile method.
That's quite fascinating. So how can Kanban be implemented in a company, and which steps and approach do you recommend?
So the implementation approach we have really follows a system thinking approach, where we sit down and ask basic questions like, what is the current capability? And we measure capability by looking at their delivery rate, the capability of delivering working software, how many use cases, how many user stories, how many features. We look at that over time. I often refer to that as the throughput of the organization. How much are we making, and what is the variability in that rate? We also look at the lead times through the system and the variability. And of course, there is significant variability because no two requirements are ever the same. So there's always a spread of variation in how long it takes to complete work. We also look at defect rates and how much of the work is being recycled for rework or for various reasons, whether it's bugs, defects, or whether it's some modification of the requirements. So we look at capability, and we also look at the demand. How much demand is that particular team or organization receiving, and from whom, how many customers, what types of work do they submit, what's the demand for each type of work, and what's the nature of the demand in terms of how quickly do we need to respond. And perhaps we'll design a system that has different capabilities according to the different types of work and the different nature of the work. So we use this term class of service that allows us to treat different work with different risks in different ways to give them different amounts of priority or focus. So we look at capability, we look at demand, and then from that we design a visualization and a Kanban system, a virtual Kanban system with work in progress limits at different stages in the workflow, and potentially with a collection of classes of service for the work and different ways of visualizing those classes of service. And that will enable us to then process the work we're receiving from the customers, different types with different urgencies or different risks attached. We'll be able to process that work through our software development organization, which has implemented a Kanban system. And we ought to be able to do that with a high level of predictability, and to be able to carefully balance our capability against the demand, or help stem off the demand, to shape the demand in a way that fits with our capability. So there's an entire system thinking approach involved in designing the visualization and the Kanban system initially, and in thinking about how we introduce it. As I mentioned earlier, people resist the adoption of new ideas for emotional reasons. And we've developed a number of techniques that enable us to identify things that will be resisted emotionally versus other things that can be introduced through simple logical arguments. So we know what can be introduced initially with success, and we know other things that should be deferred until later. So there's a couple of ideas that I like that other people suggested to me. There was a blog post some years ago now that said, Kanban is like water. This was a reference to Zen Buddhism and the idea that when water comes down a mountain in a stream, it doesn't try to move large rocks out of its way. It goes around the rock. So if In our case, the emotional resistance is the rock in the way, and it would be better for us to avoid that resistance rather than try to overcome it, at least initially. And then coupled to that, I like the joke about the psychologists and the light bulb, which goes very simply, how many psychologists does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is only one, but the light bulb really has to want to change. So if we combine those two ideas together, the evolutionary approach from Kanban is about enabling teams to come to their own conclusion about the changes that need to be made and to suggest and implement those changes themselves. So we design in the Kanban system in a way that it can be introduced with minimal resistance, and more difficult things that need to be changed and improved, we set the system up in a way that it will reveal those problems and enable team members and managers to come to their own conclusions.
I like the story about the light bulb. Makes me laugh. Now, what are some examples of companies that have successfully integrated Kanban?
So we've seen a lot of adoption in the media industry. The BBC is perhaps the most famous, both BBC Worldwide, the commercial arm, and the public broadcasting service, and some other related businesses, some of which have been spun off as independent companies. There's a company that make technology for set-top boxes that started inside the BBC. So there's a lot of adoption in media companies, quite an extensive implementation at the BBC. There are some other famous ones, Lonely Planet, or Global, which is the largest newspaper in South America. Very recently, we saw a case study published by MSNBC. We know that a number of other media companies have adopted it. We're also seeing some adoption with automotive companies. Robert Bosch was a very early example, and recently we're seeing some traction with Volvo. Investment banks, retail banks, insurance companies. One of the more famous ones is ASR in the Netherlands, a large 300-year-old insurance company with a very extensive Kanban implementation, perhaps 20 or more teams. Petrobras in Brazil, big state-owned oil company, has a very large Kanban implementation. Amdocs in Israel, which is the largest indigenous software company, telephone billing software company based in Israel. Considerable adoption in Israel. We've also seen a lot of adoption with games companies, particularly mobile games companies in Scandinavia, Finland. Also in Europe, there's quite extensive adoption with online gaming companies, gambling, online gambling businesses for some reason. Web 2.0 companies like Constant Contact and Ultimate Software doing software as a service. And firms like City Search and Tupelo, which are local search engine mobile applications. So more Web 2.0 firms. So altogether, that's really quite a broad spectrum there. And I'm sure that I'm not covering everything. But if you ask me for a summary of industries, then media is number one. Games, gaming, probably number two. There's also investment banking, retail banking, insurance, pensions. So financial sector, big adopters. And then Web 2.0, software as a service companies. And very recently, and particularly in Canada, but also in Chile, the public sector. We know that the consulting firm Deloitte, based in Toronto, have had really quite considerable success with some Canadian public sector, both federal and provincial governments.
That's an incredible spectrum that have gone into Kanban. Now, I know this question is going to come up, and you've sort of touched on it before, but I know in the audience, you know, there's people who are doing Scrum and Extreme Programming, and they'll want to know the difference between Kanban from those other Agile systems?
With extreme programming, I think it's very simple to differentiate. Extreme programming is quite rightly an Agile software development method, and Kanban isn't. Kanban is an approach to improving the agility of organizations. It's this idea that you evolve to fit. So whatever you're doing now as a software development method, rather than try and change it to something new, such as extreme programming, you simply try and improve it slowly, incrementally, in an evolutionary fashion. You don't make a radical change to something radical like extreme programming. And so there's a very clear water there. With Scrum, it's not quite so clear. If you were to pick up the books on Scrum, the first one's called Scrum Software Development, and the second one was called Scrum Project Management. So you would think from that Scrum is either a software development method or a project management method. But when you talk to the leaders in that community, they will often tell you that Scrum is a framework for change. If we were to look at the former, the software development or project management methods, then it's very easy to say that Kanban is very different. Kanban is not a software development or a project management method. However, if you look at Scrum as a framework for change, and you say that Kanban is an evolutionary approach to change, then it's a little less clear what the differences are, or how you would describe the differences. I did a fairly extensive blog post on what I saw as the difference in philosophy between Kanban and Scrum, and I think perhaps we can dig out the link for you and give you that. It's probably more detailed than we want to get into in the interview.
Well, the idea of integrating a link when the interview appears is a great idea, because I know that people in the audience would want to dig down more deeply to see the sort of the details in an intimate kind of way. So, yeah, that would be very much appreciated. In fact, to the audience, we will get that blog post link and post it with the finished interview.
Okay. Yeah, Janice will follow up with you.
Okay. And then another question on Kanban is, you know, what do you predict is the future of Kanban and the role it'll play in business?
So that's a very interesting question, because I'm always cautious about overclaiming. One of the core things we've done with Kanban is we've always reported actual results, and we've extrapolated out the theory and the models so that other people can implement Kanban and repeat those results from actual experience. So it's always been something that we've done it first, and then we've reported the real results. And when people respond and say something like, I really don't think that this will work, our response has always been, well, what was it about the story of actual events that we told you that you didn't believe? So I'm always cautious about speculating about the future, but we can certainly look at some reported results and current trends. There's been a spin-off from the Kanban movement and the Kanban community into what's become known as personal Kanban. My friend and colleague Jim Benson, during 2008, started applying what we'd learned from Kanban to his own work in our office in Seattle at that time. And what came out of that was the personal Kanban concept, and he started blogging about it. And it developed its own following. There's now a personal Kanban book. There are people doing personal Kanban all over the world. Some people are doing it with their children to help them with homework and their chores. Others are using it to manage home projects. There was a well-known Kanban implementation in London with a media firm called IPC Media. And one of their team leads started using personal Kanban to manage the building of a kit car in his garage at home. So personal Kanban has really caught on, and it has spread way beyond the software development community and is in much more general usage. We know there's an elementary school teacher in Pennsylvania that uses personal Kanban with her class. So we could look at that and say, how far do we think personal Kanban could go? And It's potentially as big as the getting things done, the GTD movement. So it's very interesting to watch what's going on with personal Kanban. And we also recognize that personal Kanban is becoming an introduction to organizational Kanban. We've seen companies, and in fact, we can attribute Kanban adoption in software development in the country of South Africa to one woman following Jim Benson who started personal Kanban with her children. And over time, she introduced it to her office and then to the Agile community in South Africa. Virtually all the Kanban implementations in South Africa can be originated to that one lady adopting personal Kanban. So we know personal Kanban is spreading the Kanban message and that it's spreading it beyond the software development community. We've recently heard reports of a law firm in New Zealand that's using Kanban to manage its case files. We know of some architecture firms that are adopting it, and we've also heard of some new media and web design firms in Germany that have adopted it. So it might be reasonable to speculate that quite a number of knowledge work professions well over the next decade adopt the Kanban approach. And if I was asked to speculate on those industries, I'd suggest that we'll see more law firms doing it. We'll see architecture firms, advertising agencies, media firms generally, full service media firms that do PR, web development, and so on. So I think that we will see Kanban break out beyond software development and IT services where it is now. And I think the personal Kanban movement has a lot to do with that. And the early evidence would suggest that many of the benefits that we've seen in software development and IT services are also possible in these other knowledge work fields. But still very early days, so I'm being very cautious.
This is quite fascinating, and the building out of this whole methodology worldwide and to different domains. So I'm curious then, what would you consider to be the one best resource to get more information on Kanban?
The one best resource to get more information on Kanban? Well, a website that we're putting a lot of energy into now, I say we, because it's a joint venture between my company and Alan Shalloway's company, is called leankanbanuniversity.com, and we can provide you with that link. And related to that, there is a community contributed website called thelimitedwhipsociety.org, and we can also provide you with that link. And the creation of that website a few years ago led to the creation of a lot of physical groups, people that meet together physically in cities. So there are Limited Whip Society chapters in many countries of the world now, in cities like Hamburg and Frankfurt, Munich, Cologne, Vienna, Stockholm, and so on. So people might find it useful to go look up limitedwhipsociety.org and find out if there is a group that meets to talk about Kanban in their area. And if not, they might want to consider starting one. So those are really the two resources, leankanbanuniversity.com and limitedwhipsociety.org.
I see a lot of parallels between what's happening with Kanban and then also with enterprise architecture. Have you done any sort of discussions with people who are heavy into enterprise architecture?
I know some people in that community. I haven't spent a lot of time chatting with them recently. I did recently hear from one individual who's quite well known in that community who was interested in trying to find some synthesis with Kanban, but it didn't develop into anything meaningful or useful, at least in the short term. I certainly feel that there's a role for architecture to play in any lean initiative, and I would really like to see more technical content being associated with lean and showing up in our community at our conferences, for example.
Now, can you overview your technical notes from the Software Engineering Institute titled CMMI and Agile, Why Not Embrace Both?
Yeah, maybe just briefly. the purpose of that paper was really the Software Engineering Institute reaching out with an olive branch to the Agile community and saying, you know, we feel that we've misunderstood you guys, and equally, we also feel that you misunderstand us. And it would benefit everyone if we clarified how Agile and CMMI can work together, and if we help educate people on both the history of iterative and incremental methods pre-Agile and the CMMI model, and really try and provide some clarity to a wider audience, people out there who are working in regulated industries or have some other reason for requiring a CMMI appraisal, and yet would like the benefits of working with Agile software development methods. So that was the premise of the paper. And without getting into the detail, there are some simple core messages in that paper that organizational maturity is important, and that it's also orthogonal to the implementation of any individual process. Really, organizational maturity is about understanding how an organization behaves when it's under stress, and how it manages risk, and how it makes decisions. And the concept being that a more mature organization will manage risk better, it will take better quality decisions more often, and will tend not to panic when it's under stress. Whereas an immature organization will tend to panic when it's under stress and will often make very poor risk management. So organizational maturity is really very orthogonal to Agile software development methods. But of course, maturity is only one of the M's in the CMMI. The C, of course, is the word capability. And that's capability being used in exactly the same way that we're using it in the Kanban method. It's really about understanding how fast can we make the software, how much variation is there in it, how long does it take, what's the defect rate like, and so on. So understanding capability is about how good are we at making software, and maturity is about how good are we at managing risk and making decisions. And Agile software development methods have the opportunity to improve our capability while being somewhat orthogonal to our maturity. So the CMMI should never have been seen as the enemy by the Agile movement. I think that's a core message from that paper. And that really what was required was a better understanding and a clearer mapping. The CMMI 1.2 book did not contain any Agile software development examples. And for many people, they really need those tangible examples to understand how to map an Agile software development method against the CMMI model and to demonstrate how to produce evidence that's acceptable for an appraisal. Those issues have by and large been addressed in the CMMI 1.3 book, and the Agile examples there were created by Hillel Glaser, who is a well-known high maturity lead appraiser and expert on Agile software development methods. He has the website agilecmmi.com. So there is now some very good guidance on how to do Agile along with CMMI. We've also seen some examples of Kanban done with CMMI. So we're very confident that these things should work together, and it's a matter of some dismay to me that many leaders in the Agile community continue to cast the CMMI and the Software Engineering Institute as the enemy and really have made no effort at all to reach out to leadership at Carnegie Mellon and invite them to be a bigger part of the Agile community, where I have seen the reciprocal. The SEI has gone to some lengths to include Agile tracks at its conferences and to invite people from the Agile community who are friendly and open to CMMI and some of their other work. With the Lean Software and Systems Consortium conference this year in Long Beach, California, back in April, we had an explicit partnership with the Software Engineering Institute, and we had Paul Nielsen, who's the director and CEO of the SEI, as one of our keynote speakers. So we wanted to make it very clear that the Kanban community is open to the ideas from the Software Engineering Institute and respects much of the research and the hard work that they've put in over the last 20 plus years. So the technical note was really designed to provide a definitive reference on the topic, and I think it's played that role by and large. I believe that the argument that Agile and CMMI are somehow not compatible has largely disappeared over the last few years, and I'm sure that the technical note had a large role to play in that.
David, you have an outstanding history contributing in the nonprofit sector or with nonprofits. Can you describe, you know, some of this work with nonprofits?
I was involved in forming the EPLN and then more recently in forming the Lean Software and System Consortium. So these are both industry non-profits which are designed were in both cases designed to encourage the development of a community, the Agile project management community in the first instance, and a community around the idea of adopting lean ideas in software development and IT services, where by far the thing with the biggest traction, of course, is Kanban. So I've been involved in forming these non-profit organizations to help develop the community, and we do that community development in a number of different ways. We hold physical meeting places, conferences, for example. We also encourage the formation of local chapters and more regular local meetups. And I support those directly with speaking engagements. In recent years, I have appeared at really a large number of the Limited Whip Society organizations around the mostly Europe, but to some extent North America, with speaking. So we encourage community meetups at formal conferences and at less formal local meetings. We provide online meeting places in terms of websites and discussion forums, and generally promote the core values and ideas behind either Agile project management and more recently in Kanban, so that the people who feel an affinity to the problems that those methods are solving can come together and feel some companionship with others that have the same affinity to the same problems. So the non-profit is about growing the community, and I think there's a core belief that time invested, my personal time and obviously my business has invested a lot of time and money in developing these organizations over the years. We believe that by growing the community, we get back an indirect benefit because that community adopts our techniques and perhaps attends our training classes or hires us as consultants.
David, in your travels and all of your extensive work, research, and working with the communities, you must come up with challenges, roadblocks, and other areas, which place demands on you in some way, and you have to overcome them. Can you describe some of these and maybe some lessons you wish to share from working with difficult challenges?
Well, at some personal level, just simply the travel schedule I have is a personal challenge, and I have my own ways of coping with that. Certainly it's important to be flying in the front of the plane and to have the use of the lounge facilities, be staying in nicer hotels. I'll often hire drivers to drive me around, particularly in cities where the taxi cabs are very cramped or dirty and smelly or unreliable. So I do a number of things to take stress out of my travel schedule. I also have an office manager who takes care of my schedule and all my bookings. I have a travel agent do my travel bookings. I really don't get engaged in any of that stuff. So that's one personal challenge, that delegating to people, and this is the core theme of overcoming challenges. I think perhaps the smartest thing I've done is a very recent thing, and by the time you release this interview, this will be public knowledge, but we haven't announced it in a big way. I've appointed Keith Mitchell. minutes. And we worked together when I was at Sprint. So I knew him from my SprintPCS.com days. And he's come in to run my business professionally. And I think that that will make a huge difference, both to me personally and to all the other employees of the firm, that we have someone who can professionally manage it on a day-to-day basis while I'm out evangelizing Kanban and working with our clients. So delegating to people and taking opportunity to take stress out of your personal life, their work situation, those things are really important. And of course, you can't do these things unless you're working with professionals that you trust.
You talked about a new hire in terms of, you know, managing the business side of your organization. And so I'd like to sort of expand that question. And what do you see as your top goals in your current position, and how you measure success against those goals?
That's an interesting question. Of course, there's been a lot of writing recently on the topic of goal setting. That theme comes up a lot in our community. The system thinking guys talk about, you know, you must have goals that you drive towards. And the complexity science guys say that setting goals and targets is wrong. We don't make those sort of specific goals. We have really a guiding light for our business, which is focus on the community. And we feel that as long as we are taking actions to build a strong, healthy community within the bounds of our economic constraints. My own business is still a small business, and we need to manage our finances carefully. We need to balance the time we spend on community with actual billable time with our clients. But our core focus is to encourage the development of a healthy community. And we believe that by doing that, our business will continue to grow and be successful.
How many people do you have in your core team?
That number changes and depends whether you include people that work for us as contractors. Currently, we have 7 or 8, depending on how you count those numbers.
Again, you know, you're in the middle of a many sort of international organizations. You're contributing to nonprofits. You have your consulting business. You've written books. You're a in-demand speaker from around the world, in-demand with clients around the world, just due to all the innovation that you've been able to inspire and produce and be a catalyst for. In all of this work, you must come across some areas of maybe controversy or much discussion, I should say. Can you illuminate us on some of those, you know, some of those areas of controversy or much discussion?
Well, there's a number of things that come up, but perhaps the one we see the most with corporate clients is this whole notion of Kanban is about evolve to fit. The reason is that 20th century approaches to change are all about managed change. They're all about defining the goal, identifying where we are now, figuring out a plan for how we get from where we are now to wherever the goal is in the future, some new process or method that we're trying to adopt, and then managing that project through the transition. So they're really managed change initiatives. They're managed transitions with defined goals. And there are whole organizations inside companies that do that for a living, that are in charge of this change agency. Sometimes they have titles like process engineering groups. More recently, maybe agile coaching groups. And therefore, to come along with Kanban, which is an evolutionary approach, where there really aren't any defined goals, that the approach is to make small incremental evolutionary changes and for those changes to reflect in some improved capability. That is really quite controversial. And in some situations, I can think of one particular client, Fortune 10 company, and I was hired to train their, as it turned out, their change agents, their process engineering people from different divisions of the company. I was hired to train them on the Kanban method, and about 1.5 days into the training, the leader of their group interrupted me and he said, "Why do you keep teaching us about change? We do change for a living. We want you to teach us about Kanban." And it then dawned on me that he had completely misunderstood what Kanban was about. And this is an understandable thing in neuropsychology, that we want to pigeonhole things into categories. And he had placed Kanban in the category of agile software development method, and therefore was expecting training on some sort of variant. There's extreme programming, there's feature-driven development, there's Scrum, and so on. Therefore, now teach us this additional variant in that category. And what they had discovered during this really advanced training that I was giving them was that Kanban, if done correctly, was obviating their jobs. And of course, that met with some resistance, as you might expect, and controversy. So we think of Kanban as a 21st century approach to evolving the knowledge workplace, the knowledge worker workplace. And that is controversial, because the traditional 20th century approach is to define these managed change initiatives with approved business plans and business cases, and to appoint change agents to manage the transition, where what we're really teaching people is the idea that they should be changing the culture of their companies. They should be making managers accountable for their decisions, and they should be encouraging leadership at all levels in their organization in order to catalyze these evolutionary changes.
Earlier you talked about Volvo, I believe, companies in the automotive industry adopting, you know, your methodology and you know, your work in this area. Have you talked to Toyota in terms of their reaction about your work and how it's proceeding worldwide?
That's a good question. We actually haven't talked with Toyota. I did mention Robert Bosch and Volvo, and there's one other automotive manufacturer that we work with. And they're very sensitive, so I can't even mention the country that they're based in. They just don't like their brand name being used without permission. But we haven't talked to Toyota. In fact, it's possible that you visiting the World CIO Forum saw some reaction there. We haven't had the contacts or the opportunity, but I really think that Toyota would understand what we're doing with Kanban and software, because it's really driving the Kaizen culture that they've developed in their company, that's embedded in what tends to be translated nowadays as the Toyota way. And in that sense, I think that what we're doing with Kanban really understands Toyota's method a lot better than what's referred to as Lean in the West. The Western definition, the MIT documented approach that's called Lean and has been adopted by a number of Western firms and consulting organizations, that tends to focus on this waste elimination as the mechanism for the pursuit of perfection. And I feel that leaves a tremendous amount of value on the table and really fails to understand a lot of the depth in the Toyota approach. So my feeling is that Toyota is about driving the Kaizen culture at all levels in their organization. It's about making managers accountable. It's about driving leadership at all levels, from the shop floor right up to the top. And it's about making small, evolutionary, incremental changes. And literally tens of thousands of Kaizen events happening, often spontaneously and without managerial permission, and taking a very failure-tolerant attitude to those Kaizen events, because every evolution, it isn't necessarily an improvement. An evolutionary approach is the idea that you make some change, and that change is either fitter for its environment, it's a better fit, or it's not. And if it's not, it will die out and be replaced with something else. I think that Toyota fundamentally understands that, and that what we're doing with Kanban is really the closest facsimile to Toyota's approach that has appeared in IT and software development.
I was just thinking if you've had a chance to sort of talk with people with the ISACA group.
I'm not familiar with that.
So that, you know, it'd be interesting. I mean, I'm actually in dialogue with their leadership, and we'll be speaking at the World Congress later this year or later next year. But, you know, they're into IT governance and auditing security, some of the areas that they're kind of specialties or, you know, they're known for, but they're also known for COVID. And, you know, the framework of COVID and encompassed within that is ITIL and some of the other kind of...
Right. These things I am familiar with. Right. So, yes, I'm sure that we would love to be talking to them. We certainly know of a few organizations that are following ITIL and have used Kanban very successfully. The Kanban system lends itself to a service-oriented approach, and our implementation approach fits very nicely with service organizations. So we know that there's some synergy there, and it would be good to explore that and try to develop it further.
I also sit on the board of the Federation Enterprise Architecture Professional Organizations, and I know that I'll be sharing what you're saying here with the board. I think there's a lot, again, synergies with what that organization is trying to do going forward.
Oh, very good.
And I have an interview, which is going to be released soon. It's already completed with the CPO of Toyota, and quite a famous gentleman in Japan, but also has done some outstanding work globally. So, again, I think I'll share some of your work here. I think you'll find it very interesting.
Okay, that's great. We'd really appreciate it. On the IT governance side, one of my consultants, Mike Burrows, would almost certainly like to follow up with that. Yeah, please let us know when the interview with your Toyota contact is available. We'd love to take a look at it. My book, the Kanban book, is being translated into Japanese, and when that's available in Japan, we will be making a tour there. So I do expect that we will have closer interactions with Toyota in the future, and we're really hoping for some considerable adoption of our approach in Japan once the book is available in their own language.
Well, I'll absolutely go forward with those three leads that I'm working with right now, because I just find what you're doing just very exciting. And we're now down to our last two questions, and one of which is not anything to do with related, you know, with Kanban or Agile or anything in that kind of vein, but it's more about the profession itself. And, you know, there are professions like medicine, law, accounting, and so on, and they have things like demonstrated professional development, adherence to code of ethics, recognized credentials. What are your thoughts on computing as a recognized profession like some of the other ones that are out there?
Well, this is certainly dear to my heart. I would very much like what we do for a living to be seen as a profession, and for that to happen in my professional lifetime. And I really don't think we're there yet. One of the goals for the Lean Software and System Consortium is to further the development of software engineering and computing as a profession. So I think that's important. There's a lot of work to be done. My personal contribution is in trying to develop the field that we're in, the Agile field, the Kanban, Lean software development field, to meet with some of those criteria, to define things like the ethics, the values that we believe in, the professional standards that we think are appropriate and required, and perhaps to put some more rigor into that in terms of the professional development and experience and examination and so forth. But it's a really significant challenge, because we work in a field where often the cost of failure or the cost of poor performance is merely inconvenience to the end user. If you look at highly regulated professions, it's often because the cost of failure was really very significant. The civil engineering profession, for example, the cost of failure was hundreds of people dying when trains were crashing off bridges or when taller buildings were falling down. And with the medical profession, the cost of failure can be individuals dying or many individuals dying of similar symptoms or diseases. So where there's a high cost of failure, government has a habit of stepping in and providing some regulation and definition. And that creates an economic environment that allows a professional body to emerge and thrive, because putting in place a professional regulation has a cost associated with it. And my observation now as someone in his mid-40s who's been in this profession for almost 30 years is that the environment doesn't lend itself to that. The cost of failure is often so insignificant that there's no economic incentive for regulation and for improving the professionalism. If it costs you $10,000 more to hire an accredited professional to do web development, you may well just hire someone who is cheaper. And your customers are not demanding that you have accredited professionals doing the work. So I think that we have a long way to go in our space to really get the general public to recognize that they have a duty to demand professionalism from their IT workers, and that they have a right to expect devices that use a lot of software, whether it's their mobile phone or their vehicle nowadays, for example, their cars have millions of lines of software. They have a right to expect that stuff to work properly, not just in terms of defects, but in terms of usability, and that they in turn, perhaps should expect their governments and their elected officials to have some say in that. So in this respect, perhaps I'm seen as a little contrarian in our industry. I'm actually for a considerably greater regulation of the industry and our profession, because I feel that it will produce very significant benefits. There's a reason that we can all get on aircraft and that it lands quite successfully at the other end, with a failure rate of less than 1 in 14 million. And there's a reason why we can go up in very tall skyscrapers and feel safe, and there's a reason we can get on public transport like trains and feel safe. And by and large, that's because the people creating these things are regulated professionals, and that governments stepped in at some point in the past and put that regulation in place. So, how do we get from where we are now to there? I think that's a significant challenge. And if I can continue, particularly through my non-profit work, to raise some awareness of the need for that and to raise the expectation of the public who are consuming the IT services and software and product development that we have, then that's great, but it will need a lot more than just a few individuals. And we have to recognize that many of the large companies that are capable of lobbying governments are, of course, very anti-regulation, that they see that as a taxation, they see it as something that will slow them down. And it's interesting to me that very few, if any, actually see it as an opportunity, that if you were better at making software products, regulation would be an opportunity rather than a threat. But very few leaders in large technology companies are capable of envisaging government regulation as an opportunity. And I think that's a pity. So perhaps there's a leverage point there that there may be some companies that may start may think regulation could be a strategic advantage. It could be a differentiator, but years away, perhaps.
Definitely an evolving process. Well, David, we're down to our very last question, and this is where I turn the tables. It's sort of a question that I use to close interviews, and that is, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Okay, well, let me see. Well, I think I might have asked, how could a systems thinking approach improve an agile workplace? What might the additional benefits be? I might also consider, what are the major challenges that the Kanban method is actually addressing? You know, if someone was out there thinking, well, evolutionary change is all very well, but how do I sell it to my boss? Then that might have been useful, because when we come up against that, we look at we demonstrate how Kanban helps with predictability, flexibility, and managing risk. And I can also imagine people saying, "What does it mean for me? How does Kanban help me in my individual workplace situation?" The sort of things we would have discussed there have come up during the interview. Things like creating a better culture in the workplace, removing overburdening, helping people balance out their work and the rest of their life, encouraging communication and cooperation, and just generally creating a friendlier, more collaborative workplace that has what sociologists call greater social capital. So, summarizing there, it would have been, how do you use the system thinking approach? What are the benefits of Kanban that I could sell to my boss? And what does it mean for me if I'm an employee in an organization that's being Kanbanized? I think those would have been the three big ones, but very Kanban specific, where I think that we actually touched on a number of much bigger and really very interesting issues. It's been great to talk with you. I've enjoyed it.
Well, David, again, considering your demanding schedule, we are indeed fortunate to have a person of your acknowledged expertise as an international pioneer to come in to do this interview. So thank you for sharing your substantial wisdom with our audience.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with David Anderson, international pioneering top authority in Agile, Lean, Kanban methodology, and CMMI.